Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levin on the Leslie Marshall Network.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. By now, you've probably seen the same video that I saw. Video in South Carolina of an unarmed black man running away from a police officer who shoots him in the back. This has happened again. And this time, at least, the officer has been arrested and charged with murder. So that's good, I guess. Except that what's interesting about this case, and the part that people haven't really talked about, is what was in the police report before the video turned up. I mean, the video is pretty clear. You can see the officer. He's standing, 30 feet away, 50 feet away, as he keeps shooting the man. Here's what we know. Apparently, Walter Scott, a black man of about age 50, had a broken taillight. That's right, his car had a broken taillight. And he was pulled over for his broken taillight. And for reasons that are still unclear, he got out of the car and ran. And the police officer tased him. Then he ran some more and ended up being shot several times until he lay dead on the ground. Now, what makes a police officer shoot someone who's running? It'd be one thing if the victim were Tsarnaev, the guy in Boston just convicted today of murdering a number of people in the Boston Marathon bombing. That would make some sense. This is a guy who's dangerous and on the loose. Interestingly, Tsarnaev, when he was captured, was not shot. But what had Walter Scott done? The guy with the broken taillight? Was he wanted for murder somewhere? Or is he just a poor guy with a broken taillight who was so afraid of the police in South Carolina, in North Charleston, that he decided that running was his best option, and I guess it wasn't. The killer, Officer Slager, white man, age 35, after shooting Mr. Scott, put something next to his prone body. Was it the taser that he claimed was stolen from him? I'm not sure. But even if he had stolen the taser, it's not like he could use it against the police officer 50 feet away. Why are police officers feeling like they can just shoot at will? By the way, I don't see the taser in the man's hand in the video. And I wonder, I think quite rightly, whether there would be any charges at all if there hadn't been a video. The police officer wrote in his report that the man took his stun gun in a scuffle after a traffic stop and that he feared for his life. Yeah, that's not what the video shows. Not sure how a fit 33-year-old man fears a less fit 50-year-old man running away 50 feet away. But I'll tell you this, if there were no video, what do you think? What do you think would have happened there? Police, all too often, lie under oath. Now, I want to be very clear. There are good cops out there. There are cops who are disgusted by this. Everyone should be disgusted by this. And the answer to protect the good cops, as well as punish the bad ones, is quite simple. It's called body cameras, and they're not that expensive. If everyone were being filmed, the good cops would be protected from false claims against them, and more bad cops would be prosecuted. Apparently, North Charleston ordered the body cameras, but didn't actually put them on the officers until the mayor issued an executive order just today. Here comes another case. I don't want to talk about it, but we have to. And part of this is part of the entire criminalization of poverty in general, right? Getting people for fines, for broken taillights, making sure they can never escape poverty. Reminds me of what Kansas did yesterday. We know, with not letting poor people go to swimming pools. There is no way out of poverty, particularly when we use criminal law to keep people in. Coming up after the break, I have a guest, Karen Dolan, who's written an article about this. She directs the Criminalization of Poverty Project for the Institute of Policy Studies. Call in. Feel free to add your 2 cents. And I'm sorry to share this news with you if you didn't know it already. 888-653-7543. This is Mark Levine. Back after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. The story changes from location to location, but is sickeningly familiar. Some unarmed black man is murdered by some white police officer, and there's a video. And the video contradicts what the police officers wrote in his report. In fact, I don't know about you, when I watched that video, my first thought was, I wonder if the hero who took the video feared the cop turning around and shooting him, too. Kill the witness. It's a scary, scary thing. And what makes it more scary is the circumstances. The man, Walter Scott, who was murdered, was stopped for a broken taillight. He's not like the Tsarnaev brother that just got convicted of 330 counts of, you know, committing his own murder at the Boston Marathon. You know, I understand shooting after someone who's armed and dangerous. I don't understand shooting after someone who's unarmed and not dangerous. A broken taillight is not grounds for the death penalty. And neither is the fact that he may have owed child support, and maybe that's why he ran from the police. What we see is that poor people increasingly, whether it be a broken taillight or child support or a fine for something they did wrong, call it jaywalking, is leading people further and further into poverty and keeping them from escaping. We are criminalizing poverty. And my guest today has written precisely about that. Her name is Karen Dolan, and she directs the Criminalization of Poverty Project as a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She recently co-wrote a report entitled The Poor Get Prison, The Alarming Spread of the Criminalization of Poverty. Karen Dolan, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Karen, let's just start with the question of a poor person, a poor black man, living in South Carolina who may or may not have owed child support. What kind of life does he have? How does someone get out of poverty if they're in that situation?
Well, it's hard to know the exact circumstances. I think that the reports do show that he had had encounters with the law before about failure to pay child support. And this is something, whether it's child support or whether it's a parking ticket, or a fine from a speeding ticket or a broken taillight, all of these are charges that result in debt. And if you're unable to pay, you are not supposed to be jailed in this country.
Yeah, didn't we ban debtors' prisons? I mean, I go back to Georgia, the colony, and the whole idea that you shouldn't go to jail for being bankrupt. I mean, that's why the Georgia was established in the early 1700s. I thought that was against the Constitution to put someone in prison for a debt.
Well, it is. So we outlawed debtors' prisons. That it brings to mind, you know, Charles Dickens and the debtors' prisons over in London. And that was outlawed in this country in the 1800s, and it was refought in some sense back in 1983 in Bearden versus Georgia about a young man who was imprisoned for not having enough money to pay his debt, and it was determined that there has to be a hearing for the ability to pay. Now, we don't know the exact circumstances with Mr. Scott, but he had apparently been jailed for not paying child support and had an outstanding warrant. Now, he has four children, and at one time when they were all under age 18, I imagine the child support was quite a lot. And we don't know the exact circumstances, but hypothetically we could imagine that there's a lot of money. And if you're out of work, something's going to suffer. It's either going to be the rent or the child support or the electricity bill or the broken taillight.
Right. I mean, it costs. Yeah, it costs money to fix a broken taillight, and if you can't afford to fix a broken taillight, you said he wanted a warrant for his arrest. Was the warrant for his arrest because of failure to pay child support?
Because of outstanding owing on child support.
See, here's the thing. I don't have much sympathy for middle class or wealthy fathers who scrimp on their child support. I'm okay with making people pay to take care of their children. I get that if you can do that. But if you can't do that, then, I mean, he's got to eat. He's got to, as you say, pay the rent. You need electricity to survive. Something's got to give. And if there's just not enough cash, I mean, what are his choices? Turn to a life of crime? We don't want that. We don't want him knocking over, you know, liquor stores. We don't want him robbing people. The Republicans oppose increases in the minimum wage to give him a, you know, so he can go and work and get a decent job. He's literally in a box, right? He has no choice.
Well, yes, and the law does protect against that, although it isn't enforced. So there should be hearings to determine whether or not, whether it's Mr. Scott or someone else, what the fine is, whether there's ability to pay.
Okay, but Mr. Scott can't afford a lawyer at those hearings, and the public defenders, I'm sure, are way overworked and underpaid in South Carolina. How is this man who I suspect does not have a legal education, how's he going to defend himself in court?
Well, that's precisely the point of what's just happening across the country. So poor people can't afford lawyers in the same way that other people can, and even there's an increase now when you have a public defender, you need to actually pay for the application for the public defender. That can be $50 or more. And then you are charged with court fees and court fines. So at every turn, there are fees that are added on top of the initial fine or the initial debt.
And all these fees are even a fees to determine whether you have to pay the fees or the debt, the fine. There's fees for that. And if you can't pay those fees, then you can't determine that you don't have to pay the fine. It's a complete catch-22.
Exactly. And then you end up owing far more than the initial fine. And so there's an increase. At the same time, there is an increase in the amount of misdemeanors that qualify for you being fined. And there is an increase in the amount of fees that are being tacked onto the fines. And there is also, at the same time, an increase in the aggressive pursuing of people, especially poor people, and statistics show people of color who may be committing misdemeanors such as traffic violations, a broken taillight.
Right, and then they have a record.
They have a record.
I mean, look, I've gotten speeding tickets, and I can afford to pay them, and I don't have a record. You know, but I've sped. I admit it. I'm guilty. I drive fast on the highways. You know, I've gotten those tickets. I've gotten parking tickets too, and I pay them because I can afford to pay them. But obviously, these people can. There was a woman in Ferguson, Missouri, when that report came out, I remember, that had, I think, $150 in either parking tickets or traffic tickets, I forget which, and she couldn't pay them, and she served a week in prison, and with all the court costs and fees and interest and delays, after several years, she'd paid more than $500 on her original $150 fine and still owed another $500 that she couldn't afford to pay and was going to continue to incur interest and charges and prison. And you know, the state of Georgia was actually designed originally to be an alternative to debtors' prisons. I mean, that was sort of the idea, was to give people another chance in America. And I just wonder if we aren't going back to that model.
Well, we are. We are going back to that model. And the case that you talked about in Ferguson, which was highlighted in the Department of Justice report, shows exactly how this is happening. And there has been an increase since the financial collapse and the recession of 2008-2009. And local and state budgets, especially in low-income communities that don't have high property taxes to bolster their budgets, that these budgets have been squeezed, and police departments and courts are looking for the revenues in these fees and fines, and they are aggressively policing in order to collect those revenues. So you see a perversion of justice where you are looking at your population, at your citizenry, as potential revenue sources and as presumed criminals rather than as the population you're supposed to protect.
Right, and that's what Ferguson did. They made a lot of money off their fines and everything, and ironically took more from the poor than the rich. And then there was this case, you probably heard about the law passed in Kansas, I think it was yesterday or the day before, that wanted to punish people on welfare who are getting like $5 a day to eat, and said that their kids couldn't attend public swimming pools. There were other things in the law. Apparently they couldn't go on cruise ships. I don't know many cruise ships that leave from Kansas. I'm not quite sure where they go. And I don't know of too many welfare recipients that spend their money on cruise ships. But the fact that their kids couldn't go to swimming pools just seemed punitive. It seems like we want to punish people just because they're poor.
That's exactly right. And there's no data to show that poor people use the very meager public assistance that they have to go on cruises or to get massages. This is part of an ideology, a way of characterizing poor people that makes it easier to demonize, profile, target, criminalize them. And we don't look at the flip side, who's receiving more welfare subsidies. Corporations.
Sure.
And nobody asks the CEO of Exxon to take a drug test.
Right.
Or says or puts any restrictions, because there's a presumption that people who are very, very wealthy are above the law.
And we saw that with in Wall Street. We saw that with the most recent bank crisis, where the banks got billions of dollars and people didn't complain as much as someone getting $5 on food stamps. Folks, if you want to call in, it's 888-653-7543. We'll be right back with Karen Dolan right after this.
We have the family of Mr. Scott with us. These are his parents right here, his brother, his children, all of his family here to support tonight. And we're just here to say we've seen all of the developments that happened. And as we watched the news where the mayor announced that the officer would be charged with murder, everyone in the home just started crying. It brought a short sense of relief and joy that the distance that we have to travel to try and get justice was beginning, and that for the first time in a long time, an officer was going to be charged when something like this happened. We can't bring Mr. Scott back, but something like this today can have a bigger precedence than just what happened here with Mr. Scott, because what happened today doesn't happen all the time. What if there was no video? What if there was no witness or hero, if I call him, to come forward.
Thank you, Lord.
Then this wouldn't have happened. Because as you can see, the initial reports stated something totally different. The officer said that Mr. Scott attacked him and pulled his taser and tried to use it on him. But somebody was watching.
Hallelujah.
There was a witness that came forward with a video. And the initial reports were wrong.
That was the attorney for Walter Scott, the victim of the shooting in South Carolina. He's, of course, absolutely right. The police officer lied on his report, and had there not been a video, it's very unlikely there would have been justice for Mr. Scott and his family. But it raises a larger question. Walter Scott was stopped for a broken taillight. I'm not even for speeding, you know? I mean, speeding at least is a danger, and I recognize that as someone who's been stopped for speeding. But a broken taillight? All right, I guess it's best to have your taillights fixed. But if you're poor and you're struggling to pay, it seems to me that stopping for a broken taillight and getting a fine for it just leads it to getting things worse. My guest is Karen Dolan. She is the author of a piece called The Poor Get Prison, The Alarming Spread of the Criminalization of Poverty. She directs the Criminalization of Poverty Project for the Institute of Policy Studies. We have a lot of callers, Karen. I want to get right to them and let you comment on what they have to say. Let me start in Nicole in New Mexico on line 5. Hey, Nicole, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you so much for bringing up this really important topic. You know, I'm in Albuquerque, and if you've been watching the news lately, you've been seeing a lot of this stuff happening in our area. My fiancé is a licensed tradesman and got caught in the recession, of course, couldn't pay his child support, and fell behind. And in New Mexico, they take away your licensure if you're a tradesperson. So he actually lost his licensure to have the job that he had.
So if you're too poor to pay child support, they're going to take away your source of income. How does that help your children? I don't know.
It doesn't help. And you know, we're all still paying the price. And it's really challenging for us. But you know, we're just going to keep doing the best we can do and keep fighting this fight, especially here in Albuquerque with the story with James Boyd, if you heard about that, the homeless camper that was shot in our foothills by police officers.
It's the poverty combining with police violence that leads to such deadly mixtures. Nicole, hang on with me. Karen, I want to ask you about child support laws. They're designed, obviously, to get kids support, but are they counterproductive now?
Well, as in any policy that requires the payment of a debt, there needs to be an ability to pay hearing. If someone has the ability to pay, then they must be compelled to pay. But if they don't have the ability to pay, then jail should not be what's on the table. Neither should taking away their income nor their driver's license, that is the ability to get to their job for the source of income.
I thought you could just garnish wages. I'm an attorney. I frankly used to do some debt collection, though I'm proud to say not against poor people. I did debt collection from rich people. But you can garnish someone's wages. You can let them keep earning their wages so they can pay for it, and you can take 10-20%, whatever the law is, directly out from the employer and pay the kids that way. Isn't that the right way to do it?
That's right. And that is not always what is happening. It varies municipality to municipality, what the laws are there. And unfortunately, in some cases, and if there are no wages to garnish, you know, then people fall behind in their child support if they're out of work. There are many reasons that people fall behind or are unable to pay or can't have wages garnished. But those indicate an inability to pay, and too often those hearings to determine the ability to pay are not conducted, and simply either fees and fines are put on top of the debt.
They're not required by law? I mean, if someone says, I can't pay this, they're not required, the judge isn't required to see if someone can pay this?
They are required by law to do that, but that isn't always what is happening, and it depends on what. Sometimes it's just summary. The judge makes a summary decision themselves. Well, I can tell by how you're dressed that you have the ability to pay.
Because we maybe once had a job 5 years ago when we bought these nice clothes.
Right.
Nicole, let me just ask you, did your fiancé get his license back? Has he paid his child support? Are you still suffering from this?
He's actually still paying his child support. They're garnishing his wages for it, which, you know what, I'm the daughter of a single mom. I totally get it. I'm totally fine with it. But basically, the fact that he lost his, not his driver's license, but he lost his licensure for his trade.
Yeah, that's
which
crazy.
Means that he couldn't go and work at any license, at any jobs where he needed that license. And so we're still actually working on that to try and get it back. And it's been almost 10 years.
Is this New Mexico law that's doing this? State law?
I don't know if it's state. I'm assuming it's state law.
I think it probably is state law.
One thing I'd
encourage you to do,
and I'm
saying this as a guy who, frankly, I'm running for a state house in Virginia to delegate here. I would call your state representative in Albuquerque. My guess is Albuquerque is a fairly Democratic area, and I would make sure that your state representative, your state senator, knows about this your situation, because they could change that law. And one of the things when I see on Just Law is I don't just say that's terrible. We can fix these things in a democracy. And have you called your state representative?
I haven't. And actually, it's funny to say that. All of the state representatives in this area, highly Democratic city, but as you guys, I'm sure you've heard about our governor, Susana Martinez.
Yeah.
And it is a huge challenge. They were in total gridlock this past year during the legislative.
I'll tell you something, though.
Capital outlay funding came out, so there's no jobs.
At least they can pass the bill, the Democrats in Albuquerque, or push the bill. You could tell your story. This is just illogical. It's not just, I understand some Republicans really hate poor people, but it's illogical. If the goal is to get children to have support, it's illogical to take someone's trade away. And that's not an issue of punishment or morality. It's just stupidity. And it's a really bad law. And I hope you're able to get that changed in New Mexico. Thank you for calling in, Nicole. I appreciate it. Let me go to Linda in Maryland on line two. Hi, Linda. How are you?
I'm real good. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a very interesting topic, but I think we're sort of approaching this whole, well, it's showing now that we're approaching the fees and charges that we charge people for civil problems like speeding tickets, et cetera. I think we need to go to a percentage of income rather than a flat fee, and that there'd be a maximum chargeable for any and all fines after the first initial fine. And because I think that this is really discriminatory to people who don't have the kind of funds. If you have a guy in a Cadillac, I don't even care, Cadillac or whatever he's driving, and he's speeding, and he's makes $100,000, and it's 1% of his gross earnings, then that would be a nice amount. But if the guy was only making $10 as his gross, then that would only be $1.
I get your point,
and it
would make the fines actually hurt equally across different areas of income, and it might even, first of all, raise more money for the city wants more money, and secondly,
sure,
it would actually make the pain equal in the sense of 10% of a poor person, or it wouldn't be that high, 1% poor person's income.
Or 0.1%, it doesn't really
Right,
make,
exactly, but it would be equal. Know. So let me ask that to my guest, Karen. Has this ever been tried anywhere? It sounds like a reasonable proposal.
Well, I don't know the specifics about whether or not that's been tried, but that is the principle behind the ability to pay hearings. And at those, you determine what is this person's ability to pay, and the judge can set the fee according to that ability, and that is what's supposed to happen before one is jailed.
So,
well,
you don't know where this has ever happened in the United States or any other country where they've actually fined you based on your income.
As a policy, I don't know of that. I haven't heard of that. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting proposal, Linda. Thank you for calling.
Well, I think you never should be jailed for anything of that nature. It should always be public service if you can't pay.
Well, absolutely. That makes perfect sense. And look, jail should be for doing something, you know, pretty severe, you know, violent or fraud or, you know, that kind of thing. You know, maybe even drug laws make me squeamish about putting people in jail for that. But, you know, a broken taillight? Are you kidding me? 888-653-7543. Stay on with me, Karen, and we'll be right back right after this.
If there wasn't a video, would it have been, would we know the truth? Or would we just go on what was reported earlier? But we do know the truth now.
That was the victim's brother, Walter Scott's brother. I think it's pretty obvious that without a video, we would not have known the truth. This is Mark Levine. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. My guest is Karen Dolan. She's a fellow with the Institute of Policy Studies. She's studying the criminalization of poverty. Karen, you were talking about the Kansas law that doesn't allow poor people to send their kids to swimming pools. I was on Fox News, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago now. It's been a while. One of my first appearances on Fox News. And they did this story on some welfare recipient in California who got money out of an ATM at a casino. Now, I don't know how they ever discovered all of that. Wasn't that horrible? And was I going to, you know, condemn them and so forth? And I reminded them that there are plenty of very poor people who work, maybe it was in Las Vegas, I don't remember, but I remember there are very poor people who work as waiters, waitresses, servers in casinos making minimum wage, who might also be on public assistance because they don't get enough money and have cashed their public assistance checks at a casino. And they had to admit they hadn't thought of that. They just assumed they were gambling. And there was no evidence that they were caught gambling. It just looks like, I can't tell you how many people I go around when I'm running for office, Karen, and particularly Republicans, and I talk to them and they say, well, what about people spending their welfare checks on cigarettes and all these things? And I'm thinking to myself, do you care when Donald Trump doesn't pay his taxes? You know, do you care about corporations that aren't paying any taxes, 3/4 of them in America? Or do you just care about where someone spends their $5 food stamp check? And I guess my question for you is, why do middle class people, rich people care so much about the $5 a day someone can get on food stamps?
Well, it's become a handy talking point to talk about fraud in the welfare system. And in fact, we know that with food stamp, the fraud level is 1%.
1%.
And that is,
I'll bet it's higher for Social Security and Medicare than that, I would suspect.
It is higher for Social Security and Medicare. And for most anything that is a program, there's fraud. So 1% fraud is very, very low. But it goes along with this idea, this assumption that poor people are lazy, that poor people are criminals, that poor people are drug addicts. And the reality does not bear this out. But these are ways in which I think people can feel comfortable with tax cuts for the wealthy and squeezing out public assistance for poor people.
Is it to feel superior?
Is
it to feel morally superior? I mean, I'm struck by even the changes in religion and Christianity. Jesus often talked about, you know, caring for the poor and the meek shall inherit the earth, and it's easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than a rich man to enter heaven. He was all about caring for the poor, and now you have some churches talk about a prosperity gospel, basically saying if you're poor, you're a sinner. That if you're rich, God loves you, and if you're poor, God hates you. It's the exact inverse of what basically was Christian religious teaching. Where does this come from?
I think it's an ideology that needs to be pervasive in order to support the kinds of regressive policies we have in this country that widens the gap between the rich and the poor. Only if you believe that people who are down and out, one, will never be you, and two, that they are there because of their own character flaws. That's the only way that you can support policies that keep people impoverished and that reward people at the very top. And many people in the middle class think, you know, in the next day, and these are the talking points that you'll hear from right-wing radio, that if only you do this, you'll be one of us, and don't worry, you'll never be one of them because their character flaws are so terrible. Of course, that isn't you. And it's just hand-in-hand. To have a regressive policy, you have to have a mindset and ideology that really demonizes and criminalizes the poor. And when you look at how these policies really play out, not only do they further hurt people who are already down and out and catch them in a vicious cycle, it also ends up costing the taxpayers far more money. It is not a sound fiscal policy to rely on.
How does it cost taxpayers more money? Because all these fines and hearings and
well, yes. So if you're fining
prison costs money,
imposing fees on people who can't afford to pay them, and then you're incarcerating them.
Yeah, that's very expensive. So, tell me this: how much of this stigma, this anti-poverty stigma, that I think has at least seems to have grown in my lifetime. I can't really tell you what it was back in the 30s when most everyone was suffering the Great Depression. How much of this is tied into racism? People put a black face or a Latino face on the poor. And I mean, it strikes to me that somehow I'm not surprised that it was a white cop killing a poor black man in South Carolina.
Yes, well, that's where you get the escalation to the violence and the killing. So you have the vast majority of people in this country who are poor are white, and they are subject to the fines and the fees and the incarceration, although at a less proportionate rate than black and brown people. But when you put on top of that racial profiling, and be it fear of black people, racist ideology, then when you get stopped for a broken taillight, by the way, he was about a block away from the auto parts store.
No way. I didn't know that. Oh, wow.
He had just bought an old model Mercedes from a neighbor, and he was on the way to the auto parts store to get it all fixed up.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and that is when the overlay of racist attitudes, structural racism, racial profiling come into play, and that escalates it from fines and fees and incarceration to violence, and in some cases, tragically, and in growing number of cases, as far as we can tell, killing.
We don't have a lot of time, but I want to quickly play the police chief and what he had to say about what happened.
I can tell you that as the result of that video and the bad decision made by our officer, he will be charged with murder. When you're wrong, you're wrong. And if you make a bad decision, don't care if you're behind the shield or just a citizen on the street, you have to live by that decision. And so we as a city want the family to know that our hearts and our thoughts are with them, our prayers are with them, anything that we can do for them, we're here to do.
Well, the first thing you should do, sir, is stop calling it a bad decision. It's not a bad decision to shoot an unarmed man in the back. That is evil. That is cold-blooded. That is murder. When you're wrong, I don't think the word wrong cuts it. It almost sounds like, oops, he made a mistake. You want to do something for the family? Stop talking like that. Sorry, I just had to get that out, Karen, before we close. Thank you, Karen, for coming on the show, for sharing your wisdom, and I hope you'll come back. This is an issue that we really need to talk about further, and I appreciate you coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Thank you so much, Mark.
All right, so tomorrow and Friday, I'm going out of Washington, D.C. I'm going to a state I've never been to before, North Dakota. I'm going to be learning a lot about an area of the country, rural America, that I don't know a lot about. And we're going to be reporting live from North Dakota. Don't miss that tomorrow and Friday. For now, though, this is Mark Levine. Follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.